I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today, gender differences. What are the differences in the male and female brain? And what other factors play a role in our gender identities? Psychologist Michael Abruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley are here today to talk about the biology of gender differences. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Mindy.
All right, so we start out with similar brain circuits, but things change a little bit after about, 8 weeks of fetal life.
Yeah, that's when it changes. We all start equal, and even though the sex is determined at the time of fertilization, XX for female or XY combination for male, the fetus is the same for the first 8 weeks or so. And because of the Y chromosome that exists in the male, the gonads or the testes start to develop and secrete testosterone. So it's the secretion of testosterone that then guides the anatomy that develops from that point on. But we're basically, we start life as females, all of us. If you don't have the testosterone, you continue as a female. If you do, you develop into a male.
So go ahead and talk about the differences then as you have the testosterone with the males and you know, what's oxytocin with the females?
Yes. Well, that hormonal difference makes for anatomical differences and functional differences of the nervous system. First off, anatomy, the influence of testosterone influences certain brain areas to grow more than they grow on the female side. Everybody has, both sexes have testosterone, both sexes have estrogen, but it's just in a different proportion is the difference. Testosterone causes certain areas to grow, and one of them is interesting. It causes the male part of the brain that is involved in sexual pursuit to grow two to two and a half times its size in the female. Hmm. That means a male has a lot more neurological real estate for that behavioral function.
And that comes in so handy in the 21st century, too.
Yes, doesn't it?
I was thinking evolution, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all evolutionary-based. Females, on the other hand, develop estrogen from their gonads, that influences the brain to develop more along the lines to equip the woman or the female for relationship functions, more along the lines to equip the female for detecting emotions in others, reacting emotions, face gazing, for instance, is more developed in the female. There's a very interesting, there's always been this debate, well, is gender biological, or is it because we behave differently toward men and males and females? And there is a biological difference. Female infants at birth engage in face gazing much more and increase it over the first 3 or 4 months to like by 400% more time is spent in mutual face gazing, where males don't develop at all that function in the first 4 months. They develop it later, but not to the extent that females do. So females are much more in tune with the relationship side of human functioning, whereas males are more in tune with things that were required of men for millions of years, which has to do with hunting and gathering and being strong, protection, those kind of things. So they're better at spatial functions, for instance, and their brain is different than the female. Better at math too.
But there are always exceptions to those rules.
Oh sure, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not really very strong on biological determinism. And just because we have the structures, they just give us opportunities. Like we have all sorts of genes inside. We have genetic expressions to be concerned with. Not all of us express the talents, latent or otherwise, that we have. So I don't want people who are listening to think that biology is destiny. It's easy to say that. Mm-hmm. It's a very shorthand stuff. But we know from behavioral psychology, the conditioned responses, we can socialize and train people, train animals, train anyone. And we're always trained by our environment, mostly unknowingly, to really develop skills and talents. So it really doesn't matter how you were born. What really matters is how you can develop it. So if we have a talent, what's the old saying? If you don't read books, then you're no better off than someone who doesn't know how to read. You know, if you don't if you don't develop your musical talent, then it doesn't matter if you have it or not.
You know, you just make me think when you're saying talents. I saw something on Facebook that just blew my mind. It's a guy who, he had a severe concussion. They were playing at a pool, and he jumped in and hit his head, and he went to the hospital, came home, slept for 5 days, and when he woke up, he had this urge to play the piano. He'd never played the piano before, and he said it was like his fingers just knew where to go. And so he was saying he thinks this is something that's inside all of us. It's just something tapped somewhere in that brain that turned that on.
Yeah. It'd be lovely to think that, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't it be?
It's a very positive attitude to
That'd
have,
be a good thing to come out of a concussion, wouldn't it?
I wouldn't recommend it.
No, I wouldn't recommend it either. But
I want to mention something about biological determinism. When we were first starting back in the, it was 1970s, about memory, we came up with computer metaphors for human memory, and that was based largely on the studies of a gentleman named H.M., Henry M., who was at MIT, and he had intractable seizures. You probably remember the story about this, Mark. And what the surgeon did with the state of knowledge back at that time, they thought that they would try cutting out some of the seizures, the structures that they thought were responsible for seizures. And they happened to hack off all or predominantly all of his hippocampus. Mm. And it was from that we realized that memory is stored in the hippocampus. But it turns out that not all memory is stored in the hippocampus, because once his hippocampus was excised, he had what we call anterior grade amnesia. He couldn't remember anything that he was experiencing, but he remembered everything that happened up to that point. So he couldn't even recognize his own parents. He couldn't recognize the researchers. He didn't remember them. So psychologists and similar folks being interested in that did some research. And from the research, we discovered that we have multiple memory systems, the biggest one being procedural and declarative memory. So Henry was able to remember complex cognitive tasks and demonstrate his knowledge and memory by performing them and getting better, which followed a normal learning curve. But he didn't know he remembered. So the difference is knowing and being able to do two different kinds of things. So they have a good example of biology seeming to be destiny, and then it turns out they have compensated for it.
I'm glad you point that out. Biology really produces the bias toward certain functions and behaviors. It doesn't. It's not the destiny at all. We know that experience changes biology. It's a two-way street. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about that, we talk about the epigenome, which just refers to genes which come at birth or come at fertilization, but are modified by turning on and off throughout the life of the organism, really throughout the life. And those changes can be passed on to the next generation because it changes the germ cells that get passed on. An experience that somebody has, we'll probably talk about homosexuality later, but it's thought that one way that homosexuality gets transmitted, there is a genetic component, and one way might be that a given individual develops the attraction toward the same sex. That changes his DNA in terms of what goes on and what goes off. That can be transmitted to the next generation, and therefore the next generation can have a bias towards same-sex attraction.
So when do children start to realize that they're a boy or they're a girl and that there's a difference? It's about 2 or 3?
I sigh because, again, psychologists who love to do research on this, there are some children who are born male who have to lose their male anatomy because of, one case I'm going to mention is just the terrible incompetence of the people who are doing circumcision. Mm. And the short answer is, about 2 to 3 years old, they realize that they're different. And researchers thought that in the case of horrific accidents where boys would, for example, lose their male anatomy, then, okay, they're so young, we can just turn them into girls. It won't be a problem. And they'll never know the difference. And so we followed, I think there was a cohort of 2, perhaps 3, I can't remember the original research on that, for 10 to 15 years, where we're trying to turn this boy into a girl to compensate for this horrific accident that the child had. And it just didn't work.
That was John Money at Johns Hopkins.
That's right. It was John Money. Yes, exactly. He was one of our very first sex researchers.
That's right.
Very interested in that kind of stuff. And we thought it was working great, you know, for about a decade or so. Then we realized that it didn't happen the way we quite thought it would. So in that case, with that child, it turns out that biology was destiny for him. Mm-hmm. And even though we thought at age 2 or 3 would be good enough, it apparently was instilled in him a lot earlier than that, and who knew?
Mm-hmm. Right. Sure.
Right. Yeah. We also mentioned that gender identity is different than sexual orientation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to establish that fact in the beginning. That gender identity has to do with the gender that the person feels they are. And sexual attraction is the object of their love, who they are attracted to.
Right. So some children insist they are not the gender indicated by their biological sex. And there's some research that says transgender people have unique brains different than males and females. Tell us about that.
Yeah, they have what's called a transgender. I mean, this one researcher says they don't have a male brain. They don't have a female brain. They have a transgender brain. And when looked at in some detail, the transgender brain is more similar to the gender that they feel they are than the gender that their biology, their external genitalia, say they are. It's different in terms of both anatomy. There's some anatomical differences and in terms of functional differences. There's some interesting research with a transgender. These were transgender teenagers after they reached puberty. Again, the anatomy was defined as different, but there's some biological functions that were different. There's a hormone that can be sniffed, and it's like a pheromone. And male brains are known to respond to it one way and females another. And the response is measured by these MRI scans. The boys that felt they were females responded like females biologically. And the females that felt they were males responded like males physiologically. Mm-hmm. And there was another group of studies that used ear clicks in the ear sounds, which also differentiates male and female brains. Same thing mm-hmm. came out. Although when they did it with the kids that were pre-pubertal, they didn't respond this way. That's interesting.
Yeah.
They may have identified as they're really a girl trapped in a boy's body. They may have psychologically mm-hmm. said that, and some kids do. But they didn't respond, at least on these physiological tests.
Yeah. Well, I'm just thinking to the pressures we put on kids to, you know, be a boy or be a girl. And I'm just going to go to the color thing because this is really interesting. Mm-hmm. Pink for girls, blue for boys. And what got me thinking about this is there's a couple of clothing lines out there now where they're trying to, you know, they'll have, a boy's overalls with pink trucks on it. They're trying to, you know, make the colors good for both. But interestingly, this pink for girls and blue for boys is relatively new. 1940s is when we started that. Prior to that, in the early 1900s, boys were wearing the pink and girls were wearing the blue. And before that, about the turn of the century, boys and girls wore white dresses until they were 6 or 7. And that would be also the time of the boy's first haircut, which I sent to you guys off the air, which explains mm-hmm. my grandfather's picture at about 5 or 6 years old with the long curly locks. So it's really interesting how that has, you know, it could have stayed pink for boys and blue for girls.
Could have. When it was that way, they thought that pink was a stronger color.
Right.
So therefore, boys deserved it, whereas blue was more
dainty.
Gentle,
yeah.
Dainty. Mm-hmm. Girls deserved it. There's a wonderful picture of Franklin Delano Roosevelt as a 6-year-old. And he's in a dress.
White dress, leather
shoes and white socks and long blonde curly hair. He looks quite cute as a girl.
Right. I think it goes into how strong a role socialization and stimulus reinforcement plays in all our beliefs, not just from the children, but also from the perception that the adults had who were raising the kids or their parents from the generation before, the grandparents. So I think we really cannot underestimate the strong influence that behavioral reinforcement has, I don't think.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking it's the same thing, you know, with toys, you know, when you insist that, you know, why can't boys play with dolls and why can't girls play with trucks? You know,
well, they have been for a long time, surely, and when they go to preschool, there's a mix. But you will see children self-select what kind of things they're going to play with. So just about every preschool for many years has had a no guns rule, no water guns, no plastic, nothing.
Right.
When I was consulting at schools, just about age 3, people came in, boys came in and started turning any object into a gun. They would get like a block
stick,
and they would hold
it
like a gun, stuck in. And it would be, what's very creative. What did this happen? Was there a TV show on the other night? What happened here? So there does seem to be something like that. And there are certain developmental levels. We haven't really researched all the developmental levels, but there are developmental levels that trigger things and inhibit other things.
Oh, sure. And there's biology that produces, that leans towards a bias one way or the other.
Do you think it's tougher on boys than it is on girls? Because a girl can act like a boy and she's a tomboy. But what's a boy who is feminine? You know,
They're bullied.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they're bullied. I think for a long time there's been what some authors call a war on boys. In fact, there was a BU author a few years ago had the book was published called The War on Boys. And for probably a couple of decades, she makes the case that society is trying to sanitize boys into becoming just maybe tougher girls. But they really don't want boys because boys, traditionally, they're kind of very messy and they're kind of noisy and they're very loud. They're the anti-girl, you know. And society would be much better off if you didn't have noisy rock and rollers, you know, noisy protesters. You didn't have these icky kind of boys thing. So there's a certain segment of society that really would like to have just girls instead of boys. And I think we've seen in certain parts of the country, they'd rather have boys instead of girls. True.
Sure.
866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about gender differences today with psychologist Michael Abbruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We're talking about the colors, and I was thinking this. Most little girls really do have an attraction for pink.
Right.
And I have two nieces who I can tell you I want nothing to do with pink. Never have. They're a little bit older now, teens now. But when they were little, it was like pink was like the dreaded color. I wonder, I mean, that's got to be something with how you know, that they see it as a girly thing or, you know, I mean.
Well, I think the only reason you could explain that is through conditioned response. As there's no biology that would make you
one color according to that.
So, and it's kids. Remember the old Peanuts comic strip that Charles Schulz used to run? Those little children had their own kind of society. They were just like little adults. And anyone who spent any time in a preschool, a kindergarten, knows that's exactly the reality. That they have their own their own society that the preschool teachers know, but the parents have no idea what's going on. And a lot of things happen over there, what's permissible, what's acceptable. And that's probably where those things come from. Something happened that they were... What's the old joke? You know, frightened by a color when I was young, and that's why I, you know, don't like that now. So something clearly went on. We'll probably never know what it was. Yeah. When they go in therapy 30 years later, it'll drive the therapist nuts.
I'll have to ask them. I've never asked them. I'll have to ask them what it is about pink they don't like. National Geographic put out a special edition in January called Gender Revolution. Robin Rantz Hennig writes, "We are surrounded by evolving notions about what it means to be a woman or a man and the meanings of transgender, cisgender, gender nonconforming, gender queer, agender, or any of the more than 50 terms Facebook offers users for their profiles. At the same time, scientists are uncovering new complexities in the biological understanding of sex. Many of us learned in high school biology that sex chromosomes determine a baby's sex. XX means a girl, XY means it's a boy. But on occasion, XX and XY don't tell the whole story."
That's right. Just for people's information, I wasn't fully familiar with the term cisgender.
I wasn't either until
I looked it up. And basically, it's the opposite of transgender. It's when your sexual identity matches your anatomy. So the, quote, the default or the normal position is referred to as cis, gender.
It's interesting because in this magazine is actually quite interesting. They have a portrait of, I think, about 15 people here representing different gender identities. And, I mean, the definitions, there's a whole bunch of definitions in here. And I think that's what gets confusing to a lot of people is, and now some people don't want to be referred to as he or she, it's they. They is a new term.
Right.
So in a lot of ways, it's hard to be aware of people's feelings and not hurting their feelings somehow by using the wrong terminology.
Yeah. Our language is sexual, is sexually differentiated.
Yeah, I think one of the issues is that it's difficult for the older generation, an older generation defined by, you know, generations about 20 years. So even people in their 30s and 40s could have much more difficulty in handling this diversity than kids do. Kids in middle school, preschool, well, mostly middle school or high school, they have a lot easier time figuring these things out and being able to go with the flow than even their parents do because it is so foreign to them. Just like learning a new language in social media, a lot of people in different generations have difficulty with that. And it's much easier to understand when you're a little bit younger. So you probably want to ask, if you can, ask your kids what's going on and what's happening in the school to get education out of that.
Yeah, to get the right terminology. Talk a little bit about the role of hormones.
Yeah, hormones are critical in the differentiation process. I referred to a few in the beginning, namely that we all have, both sexes have, let's just talk about four of them, oxytocin, testosterone, estrogen, and vasopressin are the four key hormones that both males and females have, but males and females have different ones in different proportions. Estrogen and oxytocin are primarily dominant in females. They're produced in the brain, or at least the oxytocin is just produced in the brain. The estrogen is produced in the ovaries and the brain, I think. And I think even the liver. Females have more of it. When estrogen increases, so does oxytocin. So what does oxytocin do? Well, physiologically, it has to do with the birth process. It has to do with constricting smooth muscles. So it has to do with helping the baby be born by constricting the uterus. And also there's the other one, the prolactin, which helps milk secretion. But it also has profound effects on social interactions and relationships. And it's the love hormone, it's called, or the social hormone, the one that is responsible for emotional attachments. It's very interesting, the differences between males and females. Monogamy, for mm-hmm. instance, is dependent a bit on the levels of oxytocin, or how easily it gets stimulated. It would be nice if women could have, you know, like women, when they test for pregnancy, they urinate in a cup and dip a piece of paper in and decide whether they're pregnant. It'd be nice if they could do that to a prospective mate see how monogamous he is. Maybe that'll come. Because that's what is a biological determinant of that. And there's in the animal kingdom, there's these voles, which are little rodents, like animals, very cute. One kind of vole is the prairie vole. Species, the male is very monogamous and stays around for the pups. Whereas another vole that doesn't look, I think, too much different physically, is the exact opposite. They just drop their sperm and run. Have nothing to do with the pups. And looked at biologically, the prairie voles have much more oxytocin. They even can determine that they've even gotten it down to the gene difference actually it's vasopressin receptors, which I'll explain a little bit. But the gene for vasopressin receptors, if it's long, then you turn out to be monogamous. If it's short, you turn out to be promiscuous. Mm. It can be brought down to that. Vasopressin is the male brother or sister to oxytocin. That is the prosocial hormone in males. The hormones produce differences in anatomy and function in the nervous system and in the body too. So the hormones more or less sculpt what the DNA or the genes predict. Like anything, sculpting can be messy. Mm-hmm. It can be different. And can be turned at different stages via experience. But it's the hormones that are the messengers of the sculpting that produce the male brain, the male behavior, and the female brain and the female behavior.
And when do we start to see, like puberty, where we, I mean, I'm just thinking of teenage girls and the hormones.
Yeah.
Imagine teenage boys as well, but mm-hmm. but it seems like teenage girls seem to exhibit more of the drama with the when they're going
to. Yeah, they certainly do. And again, oxytocin is very responsible there. There's studies that show that female adolescent girls when they make out, or, you know, actually with boys too, when they make out, it stimulates oxytocin. Hmm. So it stimulates the bonding process. In both sexes, actually, but more so in females. Hmm. They're more dramatic because they're involved with relationships. That's yeah. what their biological biases towards, and everything is so important with relationships. Whereas men, it's more important. Competition is more important, yeah. and strength and physical prowess is more the bias.
Yeah, and the relationships not just with the opposite sex.
Oh yeah,
yeah. yeah I mean, it's with their girlfriends too. Yeah, mm-hmm.
right.
interesting. In this National Geographic, they asked 9-year-olds around the world how gender affects their lives. I don't know why they picked 9 years old, but there were some interesting responses. So a little girl from China, and she says, "Sometimes I secretly help my older brother on the farm. Mom whacks me when she finds out. She says that girls who do these things will grow calluses on their hands and they become ugly." Mm. There's another nine. This is a little girl from the United States. "The best thing about being a girl is now I don't have to pretend to be a boy." A little girl in Kenya, "You are seduced wherever you go. You are chased by men. If you go to fetch water, you are chased. You go to collect firewood, you are chased." Here's a little girl from Canada. "There isn't anything I can't do because I'm a girl. Everyone is equal. There is always the same amount of opportunities for everyone. But in the olden days, everyone wasn't equal." Mm-hmm. But what I think a lot of what this magazine points out, too, is how dangerous it is to be a girl in a lot of countries.
Yes, yes.
You know, I mean, in life danger kind of situation.
Yeah, I think you can say that civilization, Western civilization, has progressed further than the undeveloped countries mm-hmm. certainly have in opportunity. There still is biases, obviously, and we struggle with it all the time in terms of sexual harassment and sexual crimes and all the rest of that. But we have made some leaps in cultural development that the undeveloped countries have not.
Yeah. Something else I'd never heard of before, and this is a picture of a little boy. Carlos, 12, holds a photo of himself as a girl. He's one of a small group of children born in the Dominican Republic with an enzyme deficiency. Their genitalia appear female at birth. Then with the surge of testosterone at puberty, they develop male genitals and mature into men. Talk about confusion.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you're a girl and then you're a boy and, you know.
That's quite a change.
Had you ever heard of anything like that?
I hadn't, no.
No, I think as we explore more of these socialization issues and we have more of a reach around the world by either social media or news media, we find out more of these things that clearly had to have been existing, you know, mm-hmm. for millennia. Yeah. We just never knew about it
sure.
before. And we have such a cutback in research funding now, there's no way we're going to be able to do any proper research on this anymore. So we sort of stand back and learn these things and have to learn from the people who are going through it because you can't really get a cohort of them.
Sure.
So.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about, parents dealing with their kids and gender identity. I mentioned tomboys. And you know, I guess you want to treat your kids with love, but you know, how do you know when you know your child's struggling with something like that? I think, because like I'm thinking of myself, I was a total tomboy. My mother insisted I had long hair. I used to put my sweatshirt hood over my head because I wanted to be a boy. Mm-hmm. I didn't really want to be a boy, but I wanted to be strong like the boys. And mm-hmm. so I, you know, but I could see somebody thinking she wants to be a boy. She's not a girl, you
right,
know. But
right.
you know, so at what age do you have those conversations where?
I guess all along, but you don't want to come down as a force, or make rules that you have to not run around like boys in pants. But that is what produces the conflict and dysphoria. And kids develop on their own steam, their own way. One of the toughest things as a parent is to believe that you have another individual there. And your job as a parent is to help that individual grow and survive, not become your image or fill in gaps for what you missed. That's the big challenge for any parent to encourage the growth as an individual with whatever direction that individual mm-hmm. is biologically biased towards, psychologically learned or biased towards. As long as it's within, you know, the range of acceptable human or social behavior.
Right. It's really important to have a continuing conversation about just, for lack of a better term, stuff in general. And this is just one more thing. And that children look at their own developmental changes and their parents' developmental changes different as they age. And so they will likely have a different perspective and a different point of view about the very same thing you talked about 6 months or a year ago, depending on their age. So it's very important to keep open lines of communication. And going along with what Mark said, if you really have not had a really good open line of communication with your child around age 13, 14, 15, when sexuality and gender issues may become more pronounced, then it's going to be really hard for you to have a conversation with your child about any kind of thorny gender issue or a sexual identity issue. And I deal with a lot of parents, and if they haven't had a good relationship for many years, it's really hard to try and change that within just a couple of hours. It's an ongoing kind of process. And kids themselves are very much influenced by their cultural immersion in the school system right now is the biggest cultural experiment we have going on. So kids in school district A would have a different kind of response to gender identity issues in their friends than school system B, C, or D. And or one state, Massachusetts versus Alabama versus California. So it really is very, very specific. People don't so much change without any kind of impetus to do that. We are shaped by our environment. Our environment includes our parents and ourselves, with our internal environment and also the pressures from the external environment, which is very confusing for kids to begin with.
Yeah. It's I think the one message I'd like to get across is it makes sense to be mindful as a parent, mindful about your own anxiety about talking with your child about sex, and the kids have the anxiety about it themselves. They prefer to learn from peers, perhaps. But we all are anxious about it, and we ought to look at why, at least accept that we are anxious about it, but don't let the anxiety dictate avoidance of it, because it's an important key feature about being alive.
Yeah, on the other side of that, you don't want to shock your children by actually talking about sex if that's not something they're comfortable with you, because you could just horrify them about that.
That's right.
It works on both sides. Sometimes parents are embarrassed and horrified when the kids ask them questions, and the kids are embarrassed and horrified when the parents say, so, do you want to talk about it? So you have to be aware of that.
Yeah. We're talking about gender identity, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. More after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about gender differences with psychologist Michael Abruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Talk a little bit about the difference in emotional cues.
Getting back to what we were talking about earlier about the first, say, 3 months of life and how females engage in mutual face engagement, looking engagement. The female brain is better equipped for picking up on emotional cues of another person. Obviously, it makes sense from evolution that the female brain needs to be very sensitive to the emotional cues of the baby who isn't verbal, because that has to do with survival. So the mommy brain is indeed more set up biologically for that. And the biological mechanism is thought to be what's called the mirror neurons, which are the neurons that are in the front part of our brains, nerve cells, that when the female or male sees a emotional reaction on the face of another, will respond and produce that same emotional circuitry reaction in the person themselves. They mirror what they see, what is perceived, and then reproduce it in the person themselves. So the person really knows and experiences along with the other person what they're going through. And
let
obviously,
me just jump into accentuate something when you corrected yourself and said perception, because sometimes people can perception is individual in our process. I'm looking at you, Mindy, and I may perceive you to have a certain expression on your face, and I may believe it's a certain kind of emotion. I am totally wrong about that, and that could be irrespective of the gender on that. So perception is really important. That goes into the conditioned response.
The gender difference there is Mindy is going to be more correct about reading expressions on your face than you are on hers.
That is very
And that's been shown with this research.
Right, so the miscommunication, because about more than 90% of our communication is nonverbal. Right?
Yep.
So as you can see, it would be quite a little problem if you couldn't figure out what the people around you are, thinking about or what the noise they're making is representative.
Exactly.
And generally, men are not involved with that because that's figured, that's beneath me. There's no reason I have to figure that out.
That's right.
And as a society becomes more socialized and more culturally based due to sensitivities, men really must modify their behavior. It's more difficult for them than for women.
It's more difficult because they don't have the biological groundwork for it. They don't have the brain that responsive. They have some of it, but they don't have as well as females are attuned to it. The females are definitely better at reading emotional cues. That's been shown in research where men and women look at faces, drawn faces or picture faces. Females get things right about identifying the emotion of a face 90% of the time. But when the picture depicts something that is more subtle, say a more subtle sadness, it doesn't have tears involved, for instance. Men only get 40% right, and females go on and get 90% right.
Wow.
There's a big difference.
There's a bit of difference also in the research between two-dimensional photos and three-dimensional reality. And generally, the ladies have a leg up on the guys, there's no question.
And that also gives them a leg up with intuition. Intuition is basically what we call gut feelings. Gut feelings is processed by a particular part of the brain called the insula. And in females, the insula is larger and more active than in men. So women are much better intuiting what's going on or intuiting emotional reactions of others than men. And unfortunately, in the 1600s, it's got a lot of them burned at the stake because they were identified as witches, where they were really just they were really just practicing what they were.
I just want to say that this originally started out because there was a physician who diagnosed someone with being bewitched. So we've come a long way with DSM-5 since that diagnostic.
That's encouraging.
Since you mentioned tears, worldwide in all cultures, females cry on average 4 times more than the typical male.
That's right. So what's that all about? The misperception here between men and female is men aren't supposed to cry. That's our socialization. But females are more biologically biased toward it. It expresses their deep feelings. And females feel things deeper than men do. It's hard for a male to really empathize with the deepness of the feeling. They're going to come in with a solution to the problem rather than a hand-holding, I know how you feel, honey.
Right, that's the
response.
Kind of thing that men try to do. They always try to solve the problem. I want to mention one notable example of difference in men. Remember John Bonner when he was in the House, he was the House
Speaker.
And he was reported for many years, no one ever reported this, but it turns out he could tend to cry at the drop of a hat. And only it was towards the later years that people did not mind reporting that, and he did not mind talking about that. So he was a guy who was very sensitive about it. Didn't seem to stop him from getting positions of authority,
of being
in touch with those emotions, So
an exception to the rule. Always exceptions to the rule.
Exactly. So females do take-home message here is for men when they see their partner crying, they have a deep feeling and respond to the deep feeling, not to the solution, which you might think is easier.
I'm just thinking what you mentioned, I think, last time, the movie League of Their Own. No crying in baseball.
The other difference that is parallel to this is memory, emotional memory. Females are much better at encoding emotional details of an event than are males. And the reason for that is biology, in part, because the hippocampus that you mentioned earlier, in females, is better, bigger, more active at encoding into long memory, putting into long-term storage details of an emotional experience, whereas men, it just flies right by. And this is seen, any marital therapist will tell you how arguments get going between male and female, because the woman will remember in utter detail what a slight that happened 10 years ago, and the male won't even remember the setting of it, which the female will then misinterpret it as they're not loved.
Yeah.
But really, it's not they're not loving them. It's it has to do with how the female brain is set up. Females are much better at remembering crime scenes. When they're involved in that, because they remember every little detail, tend to. Males, lawyers and criminologists have known this for a while.
One of the,
males are not so good.
One of the helpful aids is that whenever we attach emotion to any kind of cognitive ability, a cognitive event, it tends to reinforce the cognition. So if you attach memory to and attach emotion to a memory, helps you learn better.
Right.
It helps you remember more, depending on what it is. So if anyone out there has to study for tests coming up, try and attach some emotion to that.
Right.
And people who like to have the music on when they're mm-hmm. studying, people like to have a TV on, they're getting some emotional material that helps reinforce the knowledge and the learning.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. We've got an email here. It says, there are so many stories now about parents allowing physical gender changes in young children, many still in grade school. And of course, you can't change this. If these children find themselves at 20 or 30 or 40 years of age now feeling comfortable with the gender they were born with, what then? Is there something to be said for letting things play out a bit until the child themselves is more mature?
Well, sure. That's what Mark and I talked about earlier, about being in touch and being mindful and always having conversations going with your child. When I'm involved with gender change issues, and it's really been going on for a very long time, not just when the publicity hit a few years ago, it's very important to understand some people will change. And when some people talk about being gender fluid, they want to have a change. They don't want to have an operation. They don't want to have their sexual reassignment operation. They may be happy with just changing the color of their hair. They may be happy with hormone treatment or endocrinology treatment. And that may change in a few years. It may change as their social setting changes and they have other things going on. So not only can gender identification be fluid, life is very fluid.
Absolutely.
And people's behavior, we're talking about behavior, changes depending very strongly on the circumstances. So you have to always be cognizant of the fact that things may change. And one of the things that, for example, if you go to Children's Hospital and their program for people with gender change, they're very careful to say, we don't do anything right away. We do a lot of counseling,
right. Mm-hmm.
And then maybe comes the hormone. If you go to other states, which I will not name, they go right into the hardcore stuff. They don't really care very much.
Oh,
you want
really?
To have sexual?
Wow.
Yes, they do. It's
wow.
really. So I recommend only Children's Hospital, the program they have there. They'll tend to counsel children up to 18 if they're still in high school, but you have to have your parent with you.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I think they have to go to the Fenway Health Center if you're an adult. They do the counseling and the treatment there.
That's right.
So, yes, you have to be careful where you go. So if you're a parent, go to several programs if you have to, but do not go to any program that hurries up, the process and starts the endocrine changes that very first appointment.
Absolutely.
And starts with the knife, like 6 months later. Don't go there.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, don't jump on a political bandwagon because you want to be perceived as particularly liberal and accepting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We mentioned earlier that gender identity is different than sexual orientation. So let's talk about humans are not the only species that have same-sex pairings. This was some interesting research that you found, Mark.
Yeah, it's true. Lions have been seen behaving homosexually. Chimpanzees, bison, and dolphins. Our beautiful friends, the dolphins, have homosexual behavior sometimes. About 130 different bird species have been seen engaging in homosexual behaviors. So it's part of being a human. It's part of being alive, basically. Mm-hmm. And it occurs across all the animal kingdom, basically. So it's not something that humans just came up with, or there's...
I'll jump in on this. Okay, so people can easily take some people can easily take what Mark said and turn it into the justification that pedophiles have used for years, that, it's normal, it's human, everyone does it, they do it, the animal kingdom. No, that we're talking about, we're describing behavior that can and may occur, but not that's different from must occur.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And you have to be very careful because there are predators out there of every gender, every age, for every kind of motive, and they will try and confuse and addle innocent people, innocent with a capital letter, depending on what their age or what their gender is, from children to adults. So you've got to be careful. Again, we talk about this. We talk about religion and perception. Mm-hmm. These behavioral attributes and also the cognitive structures allow and permit behaviors. They do not mandate behavior.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
you've got to be careful about taking this as a justification
for
any kind of behavior like
that. Good point. Pedophilia is criminal, period.
We talked earlier, too, about, you know, when you have a child that's struggling with gender identity or you have a child that's struggling with their sexual orientation. And, you know, we talked about having good lines of communication with your kids. Not all kids have that.
Mm-hmm. No.
And some kids are, you know, they're bullied at school because of it. Mm-hmm. They also maybe are afraid and maybe rightly so afraid to tell their parents or their family.
Right. So
what do these kids do in a situation like that?
Well, they suffer a lot.
That's true. Unfortunately, they do suffer a lot. And there sometimes there's no one you can talk to, even at the school, because the school may, school counselor, school principal, someone may have a certain kind of bias against that, doesn't want to hear that, just like some parents may have a bias, and the kids know what the parents' biases are. You don't have to tell them. They'll know that.
Therapists do, too. We're not,
right. And they aren't able to know where to go. So that makes them prey for predators who pretend to care about them. And in the pedophilia world, that is called grooming, as any profiler or police officer can tell you. And kids are prey for that. So it's really important to understand, as Mark said earlier, raising kids is a very difficult thing to do because you have to help them be the people that they think they're going to become or interest in becoming, not the person you want them to be. If you want your child to be a brain surgeon or rock and roller, that no guarantee they're going to do that, and you really have to respect that. I think there are some people in certain parts of the country who are more able to do that now than they were years ago, and that in other parts of the country they're much more strict and rigid in their upbringing. But you have to create an environment that if you don't think you can talk your child about something, bring them books, bring them to a physician who's open, or a therapist who's open, a counselor, find someone who can and be supportive to your child that way.
Exactly. The other thing, just to mention biology again, biology does play on the stage here in terms of a sexual orientation. There is evidence that homosexuality does have a hereditary component. It's shown in identical twins versus fraternal twins. In other words, the statistics bear that out. But there's no gay gene. There's no specific gay gene. There are genes that have been identified that are more common in, say, gay men than not. So again, there's a biological contribution, but not a tendency. It looks like there's more of a biological contribution in male homosexuality compared to female homosexuality. Female homosexuality, being a lesbian, is more responsive to experience and love interactions than is the early biological orientation. So there's another sex difference.
I'd say about a minute left if you want to
add. I was just going to say it's important to understand that we talk about biological structures not as mandates, but simply as allowances. And they can be used on both sides of an argument between a parent and a child or a husband and a wife or social situation, school, political arguments, anything like that. So understand that these situations exist, but there are many, many other things that also come into play.
That's
so
right.
So some people may be very, very certain that they are gay from a very young age, and that certainly can be very true for a lot of reasons. And other people aren't.
Yep.
Just because one person is doesn't mean every person is or is not. It's important to understand that relativity.
And if there's a final message, don't allow religion to block conversation or block looking at these things.
Or political belief.
Or political belief, yeah.
Very good. Psychologist Michael Abruzzese, psychiatrist Mark Whaley, thank you both.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.